Hello and welcome to Paranormal or What podcast with me, your host Michaela Ford. How are you, paranormal peeps? It's been another week since we spoke. How are you getting on? Has anything weird and spooky happened in your house this week? My house has been very, very quiet this week and the kitchen has been behaving itself. Except for I did have a bit of a weird incident the other day. Now, the thing about being interested in the paranormal, as I'm sure you will know, is that you have to really, really rein yourself in when strange things happen, because your mind just goes, was that paranormal? And then you have to start searching around and not jump to any conclusions. So, I was stood in the hallway doing a really mundane thing, looking through some cookery books on the bookshelf in my hallway downstairs. And as I was stood there searching through the bookcase, a buzz happened right next to my right ear. Now, normally, if there's a buzz, I would think, oh, it was a fly. But I can tell you there aren't any flies in my house at this moment. It's very cold here and there just aren't any flies around. And also, if it was a fly, I would be able to have heard it flying away. And this was a slightly different sort of buzz. It was almost like just, it was a 1 second, quite loud vibration right next to my right ear, and the sound went weird, and I almost got the feeling that it was like someone trying to speak but not being able to come through properly on a radio or something. It kind of went bzzz, and then that was it, and I looked around and there was nothing there, and so I have absolutely no explanation for it, but it was definitely outside my ear. It wasn't in my head. It was maybe 2-3 inches away from my ear, and it was very strange. So I don't know what you make about that. If you've got anything to say about it, then please put a comment on the Paranormal or What Facebook page. So this week, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be interviewing a very interesting man called Jason Hewlett. Jason's a journalist and a broadcaster, a filmmaker, author and podcaster. He's a very busy man. And he lives in Kamloops, British Columbia in Canada. He's the co-founder of the Canadian Paranormal Society with a man called Peter Wren. And he's the writer, director and creator of an online docuseries called We Want to Believe. And it's well worth watching. It's on Amazon Prime. He has an upcoming Small Town Monsters production, which he's doing a Kickstarter for, called Cursed Waters, Creature of Lake Okanagan. He's also written books, Want to Believe series, One Man's Journey into the Paranormal, and I Want to Believe, An Investigator's Archive, and Dying Light, An Investigation into Near-Death Experiences. So, as you can imagine, he's a very knowledgeable man about the goings-on in the paranormal, and we had a really, really interesting conversation. So, what you need to do is you need to sit in a very comfy chair. You need to get your headphones on. You need to get a tot of something hot and spicy. And you need to put 1 hour and 8 minutes approximately aside to listen to the wisdom of Jason Hewlett. See you out the other side. So today we have Jason Hewlett,
And he is a journalist, broadcaster, author, and podcaster. And I will be asking him all about those things during the interview. Hello, Jason. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, and thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
It's a pleasure. And you are a long way from me at the moment, aren't you? You're in Canada.
Yes, a place called Kamloops, British Columbia, which is like 3.5 hours northeast of Vancouver and about 2 hours northwest of Kelowna, of course, where Lake Okanagan is. So yeah,
Wow.
right in the interior of the province.
Gosh, and so being British, I've got to ask you, what's the weather like?
It's cold right now. It's cold. We've had one of our famous Canadian winter cold snaps. It's just kind of easing up. We've had our snow and everything, so it's still very much winter here in Canada. How is it in the UK?
Wet as
Wet.
usual. I'm afraid where I live right on the south coast of England in this lovely little sheltered spot, where we never get snow. We haven't had snow for 6 years.
Wow, I
I
can't even
know.
imagine what that's like.
It's really depressing, especially because in my real life, I'm a primary school teacher, and the children are always asking me, when are we going to have snow? And I
Right. Well,
say,
kids
well,
love snow.
they do. So we keep having to learn about global warming and climate change, and then I explain why we haven't got snow anymore.
Perfect.
Right. So we are here to talk about lots of things that you've been doing. But first of all, I must ask you the question that everybody always asks everybody, which is, how did you first get into the paranormal?
It's like pretty much everybody who's interested in this subject matter. I had something happen when I was a very young boy that kind of sparked my interest in it. It's kind of a fascination I've had for as long as I can remember. But when I was about five, I was with my mom and we drove to pick up a friend of mine who was going to sleep over at my house that night. And she went to the door to get him, and I stayed in the vehicle. And it's, I don't know if you guys had them in the UK. They were called Gremlins. They're like this hatchbacky car that looks kind of like a Ford Pinto sort of
Oh,
look. They're hideously ugly cars.
okay.
And this one was purple, which made it even worse. But it had this hatchback. And I could remember sitting in the back seat looking out the back window, and I'm in the street being completely bare. Like it's one of those things, even though like I'm 51, I can still remember very clearly. The street's bare. There's no one around. I'm hanging out in the car. And the next thing I know, this face appears in the back window that I can only describe as being kind of mongoloidish. You know what I mean? Like it was just all
Oh,
deformed and weird looking, kind of like, Jason Voorhees from the Friday the 13th movies without his hockey
wow.
mask kind of thing.
Yeah.
And
Ooh.
it's like 1 second it's not there, then it's there, then it's gone.
Oh my goodness.
And it freaked me out. And I remember like dropping to the floor of the car and not wanting to look up until I heard footsteps come up. And it was my buddy, John. And I sort of said, "Were you running around the back of the vehicle?" And he's like, "No, I just got here." And I asked my mom, like, was she around or did she see anyone? And she's like, "No, not at all." And there was no one on the street. And they said, "There's nobody around." So I explained it. And they didn't understand how I could see something when there was nobody there. Because you'd have seen someone run away or run across the street or
Yeah.
something like that. So that was kind of the first real tangible thing I had happen to me. I could always remember being like an anxious kid and like having a weird fear of the dark that persisted far longer than most kids have a fear of the dark. But that was like the first real tangible thing that set off, reading books on the subject, wanting to watch, every TV show that came around. Like I was a big fan of the original In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah.
Like unsolved mysteries, shows like Sightings, and I just d devoured content on it, trying to figure out what it was that I saw and what it is that I keep thinking I'm feeling around me, kind of thing. And that's where it started.
Yeah. Wow. I think we do all attend to the people who become sort of almost obsessed with the paranormal. It's always trying to explain something that happened when you were younger or an experience that happened. Have you come any closer in your quest to sort of explaining what that might have been? Or is, do you think it'll just always be unknown?
I think, like, because I've been sort of investigating off and on for about just over 20, about 21 years now, and I've been a part of a group for since basically 2017 where we've done serious investigations, and we approach it from a scientific standpoint or as scientific a standpoint as we can. And I think, Yeah, I'm convinced like that there's sort of something out there that's kind of around us all the time, that I think is a very natural phenomenon and a natural part of this planet. We just don't fully understand it. I think we understood it a lot more when we were, I guess, less civilized, you know what I mean? And not living in like cities and creating a society with light and noise. I think when we had to survive more off the land and be more in tune with nature, we kind of tapped into it more. And so I think when there are those of us who are kind of a little more in tune, and the more you look, the kind of more in tune you get to it, as long as you're open to it. And that's when you see and experience it more. What it is, I'm still not sure. Like, is it, are we touching on kind of, is it the spirits of the dead, or are we touching on sort of a different timeline that's running parallel to us? You know what I mean? Like, is it like the multiverse thing? I think there's a lots of possibilities out there. I don't know quite which one it is. I have ideas. I'm a big fan of multiverse. The multiverse concept, you know what I mean, or layered time. But yeah, that's kind of as close as I've got right now to an answer.
You know, I really like that though, because there are so many people that I interview and they have a definite idea of what they think things are. But I think you need to be fairly open and flexible. My opinions change all the time. Sometimes when I think I've got a handle on what I think something is, something will come along to sort of take my feet from under me, and then I have to start all over again. And I think you need that sort of outlook, don't you? Not to be so set in your ways.
I think so. I find it really, it's like Bigfoot's a good example. Like, there's kind of the camp that says it's just a monster. I think it's the same with all cryptozoology. Like, there's people that say, nope, it's a flesh and blood creature. Yet there's enough accounts coming in that suggest it's more than just that. And you got to take into account, like, you know, indigenous people's beliefs on the subject. So I think you've got to be, yeah. I get leery when people are like, nope, it's just this. Or they say that they're an expert on the subject, because I think that's impossible. You need fluidity to it, because I think it's something that is very fluid. It's not this tangible thing. I think we'd like it to be tangible, that we could finally just definitively say it's the spirits of the dead coming back. But I think it's a lot more complicated than that.
Is. Yeah, I completely agree with you. Wow, we really just dived in there, didn't we? No
We did.
messing about. No, I love that. And I love the fact that you're kind of on the same track as me, because sometimes I speak to people and I just think, nah, I don't agree with you at all. And it's really nice to speak to somebody who's on the same sort of wavelength, which is brilliant.
Likewise.
So I've got many things to ask you. So I'm going to go down my list here. First of all, the first thing I discovered about you is that you are the co-founder at Canadian Paranormal Society. Can you tell me what that is and how it came about?
Yes, it's a paranormal investigation group in Western Canada. What happened? It's a bit of a story, but back in 2017, that was right before Halloween, and I was kind of, I my son was young, like he's 12 now, so he was, what was that? We're going back 6 years, so he was six, so he'd get up early on weekends, so that was my turn to get up with him. And there was one morning on a Saturday when he was watching cartoons and playing with his toys at about, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning, and I was randomly surfing the computer, I came across a group called the Vancouver Paranormal Society, which is kind of the oldest, you know, government registered society, paranormal investigation group, kind of in North America. And they were looking for members. And I'm like, oh, I've always been interested in this, and I've mostly done it on my own, you know, haphazardly kind of thing. And it would be kind of neat to see if I could tag along with them on something. So I, you know, I sent them an email and applied, and they got back to me. And the gentleman that was then the president of the Vancouver Paranormal Society is a man named Peter Wren. And he's actually from the UK. He's from Croydon. And he's kind of done this all over the world. And so he reached out to me, and we chatted, and through different circumstances, he and I didn't get to investigate right away, but I went out with the team, and I became an investigator, and then eventually like a lead investigator and society director. And Peter ended up relocating to Kamloops. So we started working together, you know, going on investigations together, and found out we had a real good vibe, and he's become like one of my best friends. And when COVID hit, and there was the lockdowns, like in the province, you weren't really allowed to travel very far, as it was like in a lot of places. And so Peter's like, we're both in Kamloops, why don't we just kind of form our own group? because we can't travel to the coast and investigate with them. So we let one of his team members take over Vancouver Paranormal Society. He and I formed the Canadian Paranormal Society, and we've just kind of gone from there. And we sort of investigate residential hauntings, commercial hauntings. We go to, you know, historical sites. We don't just limit ourselves to investigating ghosts. Like we're open. We investigate, like, you know, Sasquatch, you know, UFO sightings. We kind of like to get our hands in kind of everything that way. We don't charge for our service. We do fundraisers for like heritage societies that are looking for money. Like we'll do presentations and run ghost tours and things like that. So we kind of like to do a little bit of everything within the realm of the paranormal, and we do it for our own reasons. And we like to also help people as we go along as well.
Yeah. And since you've been doing it, have you, I mean, I presume you've got, you've documented in some way all the different cases that you've taken on. Have you found any similarities between cases, or are they all very different?
It's funny, like some of them are very similar, and then some are dramatically different. Like it's interesting. Like we've been to some locations, especially like the residential ones are really interesting. Like there's some residential ones where it's more than one spirit, and you get the impression that there's definitely more than one spirit, because like, for example, in this one place, it's a two-story home with like a ground level and an upstairs, and there's activity on both floors, but the activity in the basement sort of way more sinister, you know what I mean, and just more off-putting. Yeah. And it's almost there more to scare. And then on the main floor, it's more just something trying to communicate, primarily through electronics, right? Like, which is, yeah, I find very interesting. But there's another residential case where it's like it's very consistent, and it's more just like, you know, people seeing a shadow or things moving, you know, the traditional kind of ghost story sort of stuff where, like, you know, the kids wake up at night and see something that scares them, or the doors kind of move, or the sense of being watched. Historical sites are interesting. There's places which are supposed to have a storied history.
Yeah.
Right. Like but you go there and, you know, and everyone's saying, oh yeah, it's really scary and there's lots of activity and blah, blah, blah. And then you go there and nothing happens for the whole night, right? But then there's other places, like I keep thinking of one called O'Keefe Ranch, which is a historic cattle ranch that's now open to the public, where there's been sort of three defined stories, and we've been able to find evidence to support all three.
Wow, that's kind of fantastic. Thing,
right? Yeah, so I think, and that's kind of why I have my view that you sort of share, there's no consistency to this stuff at all, right? So it makes it really hard to say that there's the same thing. I found evidence to support, you know, residual hauntings. I found evidence to support intelligent hauntings, poltergeist activity. I think all these things that we've kind of classified as paranormal and the different types of hauntings, I think there's enough evidence I've found over my years to support all of them.
Yeah.
All of the different theories behind it, you know, like stone tape theory, you know, portals, poltergeist, negative energy. We don't like to use the term demonic because we're looking more spiritual. We're not so much spiritual, we're more scientific based. So I think there's enough evidence to support all these things that people have been experiencing for, you know, I think as long as humans have been keeping track.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
But nothing to say that there's consistency to it.
Have you investigated some places several times? So you say sometimes, obviously, we all know that you can go on an investigation and nothing might happen. And the people are saying, no, really, things are happening. And then you have to go back time and again, and then you eventually get something. Has that happened often?
Yeah, we're lucky. I mean, there's definitely places we go to which are one-offs, and we'd love to go back, but the people just don't want us to come back for whatever reason. Maybe like we've been able to show them something and they're content with what we found, or nothing's happened and they think that we're a bunch of idiots, or you know what I mean? But we've got a few residential cases that we've been able to go back to multiple times, which is fantastic. Right now we've got a building that we're investigating, which is, we had to sign NDA, so I can't really say where it is, but it's, we've been able to go back as much as we want, and we can keep going as much as we want sort of till a finite date, you know, like in June, I think. So we're going back over it. We want to get sick of the place.
Yeah.
And we're trying so many different methods, you know what I mean? And we're getting very consistent activity. We're getting the same names coming up in our investigations. We're finding evidence that supports the story surrounded to it. And that's a goldmine as an investigator. It's as close as you can get to scientific method, where you can like come up with theories and then test them repeatedly. Which we love that. And, you know, we were just back actually on the weekend for the third time. We were invited back for a fourth. We can't wait to go back and do like an all-nighter. You know what I mean? Like, it's, we really like it. So we've been lucky to have about three or four places that we can go back to that are not just residential, but commercial and also historic as well.
Yeah. And do you find that people want you to literally just maybe find out what it is, or do they want you to get rid of it because they don't like it, or it, could it, is it sort of lots of different things?
I think mostly it's people, like for the most part, it's people who just want to feel that their experiences are validated, that they're not going crazy. Because it can be very disturbing when stuff happens. I mean, I've lived in places where there's activity. If you don't know what's going on, it can really throw you for a loop. But as soon as someone kind of comes in and says, yeah, like we're getting something, we don't know what it is, but there's stuff definitely going on here and we've experienced it too. That kind of makes, I think, most people kind of content. And then we sort of ask them, well, what do you want? And a lot of the times people are just more than happy to have it there. They just know what they, as long as they know what, that there's something there and they're not nuts.
I think
that's
the
norm
very
I'm
important.
Finding.
Yeah, it's very important to people, I think. Not to be going mad or imagining it, or and yeah, I can imagine that that validates their experience. Do you have a particular favorite piece of equipment, or is there anything that you definitely wouldn't use?
I like, I mean, we as a group, like we try lots of different things, more to try them, but we like to stick with the basics, like a digital recorder, you know, a pad and paper to take notes, right, or jot down times. That's kind of what we use the most. And then we do like to use a spirit box, with the understanding that it of what it is, and that it can, it picks up radio signals. So you have to be really careful of not just taking everything that comes through it as like, you know, a ghost or something talking to you. Like, you kind of got to really do your research and ask very pointed questions that relate to the history of the place. And if something comes back that validates it, like a name or you know, a word that ties into the story that we've heard about the place, then you kind of can use that as you know, more closer to evidence than not. We do use cameras to document what we do. And then, yeah, we like to play around with things. Like one of my colleagues, Olivier, he came up with something that it uses the spirit box, but you attach it to the, it picks up vibrations, the vibrations in a building or a place. And it will then use that to create words. We just started playing around with that, which was interesting. We've only used it the one time, so I can't say how accurate I believe it is, but it was really interesting to use that. We don't use apps for obvious reasons. It's programmed to do that. I remember I tried one out once at a residential haunting. So I turned it on and I kind of asked my question. This random word popped up and then it asked me to pay $5 for a monthly subscription. So I immediately deleted it. And that was the end of that. And I just refused to use it. And then other things like an ovilus, like things that are like, if a computer is programmed to run it and have pre-programmed words in, how do you know what? It's just throwing out random gibberish. Right. So we stay away from anything like that. We try to keep it as simple as possible.
I think that's a really good idea. Otherwise, I've been on so many investigations where people start creating their own narrative through these ITC devices and apps. And I stand there thinking, what, you're just making this up now? You're kind of stringing these words together and making up your own story. That's ridiculous.
It is. And I mean, as people, that's what we do anyways, right? Like we like to kind of make sense of things. So yeah, if you're, and I mean, you're already going into a place with a story that this place is haunted. So you're automatically looking for that already. And that's, it gets dangerous. Like there seems, I think to be a good investigator, you need to be detached a bit from things. Like my background's journalism. I was a crime reporter. And so I was trained to look for both sides of the story and to compile facts and not jump to conclusions. So I really you have to remind myself of that when we go into these places, because I catch myself getting caught up in things, especially if you already know there's a story attached to it.
Yeah.
And you're almost looking to support that story. So I think everything that happens in an investigation, you have to pick it apart first, and then kind of use the Occam's razor theory, right? And if what you're left with makes sense, that it supports the story of this place, that's fine. Yeah. But that doesn't mean that everything that happens after is paranormal. You got to take every little incident and break it apart individually that way. And I think we have to remind ourselves as investigators that that's what our job is. We're not there just to kind of, oh, cool, it's haunted, and then just piece it, you know, just go willy-nilly and take all this stuff and create a story around it.
Yeah, I think this is one of the things that because I'm very interested, and I know a lot of people don't watch them, but I'm very interested in watching other people investigate. So I watch a lot of shows as well. I'm just really interested in how they do it. It doesn't matter because you can't really believe what's on TV anyway and on YouTube because you're not there. So I just take it with a pinch of salt, but I still love it. And sometimes you sort of think, wow, I wonder if it'd be really different if I was actually there. And you do wonder sometimes whether they're sort of creating their own content. Is
Definitely.
there any time when you've investigated where you've actually been scared?
It doesn't happen very often, which I think a lot of people think it's got to be this scary hobby, but it's just really not. Actually, it can be really boring. Most of the fun comes from the people I investigate with. We have a good time doing it, and we kind of, you know, take it with a little bit of a sense of humor, etc. Because you are sitting in a dark room talking to nothing, right? So you got to kind of have a bit of fun with it. There's been a couple times though where I have been. One, it was like when I was really just getting started, and it was myself and a friend of mine named Donna, who you know is an alleged psychic, and I use to say alleged because I don't know, kind of thing. But I had some good luck with her, and we vibed really well. And we were at a place outside of town here called Tronchial Sanitarium, and it was a former tuberculosis clinic that was turned into a mental institution. And here in Canada, we deinstitutionalized a lot of them, sort of in the late 70s, early 80s. So it's sat empty. And of course, as soon as it sat empty, there were stories. Like when I was in high school, people would break into party out there and do drugs and say they saw all sorts of things and that kind of stuff. And so I did an investigation out there when I was in journalism school. And it was interesting. I got a bunch of people together. Like I got someone who said they had an incident out there. I got someone who was with a TV crew, so he had cameras. I got a skeptic, and that's why I met Donna, and she was a psychic. We went out and nothing happened while we were really there that night, but I knew the caretaker and I could get back in. And so I went in with Donna one day, and we went during the day this time, and we investigated, and we had some eerie things happen. But because it's Canada and the winters here can get pretty extreme, all the buildings at Tronchial are connected by a tunnel system. And so we went down in the tunnels, and we were, yeah, and there's no lights in the tunnels.
A tunnel in a sanitarium, that is the ultimate fright fest for me.
It's design. Oh yeah, like it's creepy. And we were kind of investigating. We were doing our thing, and we came out in the basement of what is the laundry building because it's very much a city. It's its own little city. We were kind of done for the day, and it's like we should get back to the car. It's about 4 or 4:30 in the afternoon. Should we go back on land, or should we go back through the tunnels and do one final crack? And we decided we'd go back through the tunnels and take one final crack. And I got to point out the doors in these tunnels are very much. They're not on hydraulics or anything, so you can just kind of push through them, kind of like batwing doors. So there's no resistance at all. So we just come through these doors. I turned around, I reached out, I grabbed the door, I opened it, I got it halfway open, and something reefed back on that door with enough force. I'm 6'1". At that point, I was like, you know, maybe just shy of 200 pounds. I was pulled off my feet and I hit the door.
Oh my goodness.
And Donna ran, and I'm not ashamed to say I ran right behind her. And
Wow,
that turned me off investigating for quite a while. Like,
gosh, yeah.
yeah, that was scary. That was like the most scared I've ever been doing that. Because there was
Wow.
something down there could generate enough power to physically move somebody. And if they could do that, what else could go on? And there was no one else down there. You know
Did
what
you
I mean?
hear
Like, there's
anything up at all?
no, and you think if someone was walking, you'd hear footsteps or something, or they'd pull back on it, and they'd make like a huh sound. There was nothing. It just bam. And so that was terrifying. And that was the most scared I've ever been. There's been moments where other stuff sort of happened, which is more just surprise. Like there is that bang. Like the other day we were at this location and I went and did the whole, all right, you know, if you're here, you know, just even just knock on the wall a couple times. And I knocked, I did the two knocks. And as soon as my hand moved, it was like knock, 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 which wasn't me. There was no one knocking. And so that made me jump because it was like just immediately after I had knocked, right? And usually you wait a while and then you get like the knocks if you get knocks at all. So there's moments like quite a few moments like that where you get startled, but that was the scariest was out at Tronchial.
I find it so fascinating that I mean, for want of a better word, let's call them ghosts, that they can come into the kind of physical realm and be physical. So when that when it was pulling the door from you, it created some sort of physicality, but then that can dissipate again. And then you imagine that when they're knocking, I mean, I don't know whether they're actually knocking with their knuckles like we are, or if they're just creating that sound, because it has a weird kind of hollow sound, doesn't it? Almost like it's not there. And it can sound like it's on wood when you're next to brick, and it can sound very different. But I find it so fascinating that they can somehow manifest themselves to be physical.
Yeah, it's crazy, and that doesn't happen very often. Like, it's pretty rare. Like, I mean, horror movies will make you think that happens all the time, but it's, I can count the number of times I've, something like that's happened, like on one hand. Like, I mean, I've had a toy thrown off a shelf, right? And you do see the door move, but it's not like suddenly it's like slam. You know what I mean? Like, they make out and things spinning around or anything like that. But yeah, it's, and you're right about the knocks. I never thought about that. It sounds just different enough from the regular natural knocks that we make. I find that to me is one of the most fascinating things about this. And then yes, and then they can actually really move something, like enough to move a person.
It is. It's just fascinating. And I find since I've been investigating, which is probably about 15 years, I've got more questions now. I haven't got any more answers than I started with, but I've got a lot more questions.
Same. And I think that's the nature of the beast, right? I don't think we're ever really going to get those answers. Like, I don't, until like we go wherever we go next. Then maybe it's like, oh, okay. Right now I understand how all this works.
Or maybe they won't let us know, which will be really annoying.
That will be very frustrating. It's like, come on, bunch of jerks.
I've waited all this time. Okay. So I wanted to ask you about your documentary series, We Want to Believe. Now I went on to Amazon and I put it on my watch list so that I can have a look at that. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, We Want to Believe is, it was just literally us having the opportunity to document, what we're doing in a way, that we want to sort of portray what goes on. Like, Peter has been approached, by like Netflix and various production companies to be on shows, because he was a part of TAPS, which is of course where Ghost
Oh,
Hunters and
yeah.
Ghost Hunters International started. But he's, because he sort of sees how the behind the scenes work from just knowing all those people, he just didn't want to do it, because there is definitely an influence from, networks on making sure things are scary and that something happens every episode.
Yeah.
But we know that's not the case. So we were initially approached by Joe Blow Media, who are starting kind of their own YouTube channel dedicated to horror movie content, to do the show on that. Because I know John Fallon, who's one of the people involved in Joe Blow Media. And so we originally created as a YouTube show, presenting our cases in a very, undramatized way, and that sort of
Yeah.
became the theme. When it moved from that channel to another channel that I ran for a while, and then it ended up on something called Paraflix, which we're not involved with them anymore either. But we've got people interested in sort of picking the show up,
Yeah.
and continuing it. We have 12 episodes. Like, I think there's about eight, nine that we filmed that did broadcast on a couple different platforms, and we cover everything from, like, we did some residential hauntings in there. We did like O'Keefe Ranch. We did Barkerville, which is like a ghost town up in the northern British Columbia. A place called Bailey House, which is a big history here in the interior. And yeah, we are documenting our investigations and telling the stories of the places that we are investigating. And that, to us, especially when you go into like places like an O'Keefe Ranch or a Barkerville, it has such a storied history that the paranormal is tied into. So we want to explain what happened there and
Yeah.
then how that could relate to the activity that people are experiencing. And then we like to go in and investigate and show what we find or don't find. And it became very important for us that even if we do an investigation where nothing happens, that still needs to be an episode so that people can see that there isn't something happening all the time.
Yeah.
And we got criticized for this, because We did episodes where we filmed it in the daytime because that's when we investigated, because this activity can happen anytime. It doesn't have to happen at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be dark. And like I said earlier, it's quite often not scary. So you can't make something that's not scary scary. I think by doing that, you're doing a disservice to the viewer to make them think that this is something that they need to be terrified of, because most of the time it's not. And so
Yeah.
that kind of became the mission statement of the show. Whereas even the earlier episodes had a disclaimer saying this takes a very a very scientific, un-Hollywood approach to the
Yes, I read
pseudoscience of
that. Yeah.
paranormal investigation. And that's kind of the important message we're getting from it.
Yeah, and I
Everyone
think
was
that
welcome.
then separates the viewers, doesn't it, into two camps. The ones that hopefully are watching your show are the ones that are sincerely interested in the paranormal and maybe investigators themselves, rather than the people who want to watch the shock horror things on YouTube and be scared. They're very different types of people, aren't they? And often, and from what you're saying and from my experience as well, you end up going into a lot of history, of the places that you're investigating. And that's another thing that makes it interesting, as well as the sort of activity, isn't it?
It is. I find that the history is often as interesting as the activity going on there. And they're kind of one and the same. They're tied into each other, right? Like you
Yeah.
can't be a paranormal investigator and not know the history, even if it's a house. Well, who else lived here? How long has there been activity? Did it start when you moved it? You know what I mean? There's so many different
Yeah.
questions we asked. And then even like there's like questions like, well, is there any history of mental illness? Is anyone here taking narcotics or drinking alcohol to extreme? You know what I mean? Or on certain
Yeah.
kinds of medication? Because that can all tie into what's going on. And so I think, yeah, that was really important to put across in the show. And we've got some really good episodes coming up that I'm excited to show people. And we've gotten better at filming it, you know what I mean? And making it more authentic too. Because when we were on YouTube, Joe Blow wanted enough to make people interested in watching it. And so we had to figure out how to make it kind of like those shows without it being like those shows. You know
Yeah,
what I mean? To
yeah.
keep people interested. But now that we're off that platform, we've been able to get more authentic with it as well, which I think is for Peter and I the most important part.
Yeah. Have you have ever had anybody who was so sort of insistent on you seeing what was happening at their place that they sort of not well sort of embellished things or faked things? Have you ever caught anyone out?
Yeah, like there's been a couple times. There's been one haunting that we've investigated a few times. We went back 3 times, I think. And what the people were saying was happening, we just didn't have anything to support that. We did have stuff happen in the house, but not to the degree that they were describing it,
Yeah.
right? And then they showed us a video that the daughter had made where there was these weird voices on it, but that was something that was pretty easy to pick apart as just the speed upon which the video was playing. You know what I mean? Like it was just,
Yeah,
it
yeah.
seemed like they did have stuff happen there, but they almost wanted us to be more excited about it than what was actually going on
Yeah.
in the place, which is too bad. And then there's one place I investigated, which was residential, and they were like talking about like water materializing out of nowhere and filling rooms and blood dripping from the ceiling and all this stuff. And I went in with the investigator at the time. This is back when I was with Vancouver Paranormal, and like, there was no vibe to the place. The basement was a bit off feeling, but it's a lot of basements just feel weird, especially when that it's still like 50-year-old down in the basement. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And we just had no activity, like none the whole time we were there. And when you looked around, like there was lots, I think on DVD, they had every season of Ghost Hunters and all these shows, and they had books on the occult, and they just wanted there to be something
Yeah.
there. And I don't think there really was, sadly, like the teenager was transitioning from one gender to another. And I think that was playing a part just in terms of
A
where they
lot
were
of,
at
yeah.
psychologically. So yeah, it's unfortunate, but there was just nothing. And we sort of said that we didn't find anything, and we didn't even feel anything off-putting. And I don't
Yeah.
allege to be psychic, but you can tell if there's something going on in a place or if a place has a bit of a history.
Yeah, you can. And then I suppose there are also, I mean, I found this as well, there are places that you go to and you don't expect anything from them, and they end up being the best place because loads of
Yes.
things happen.
Yeah, loads, loads and loads and loads. You know, it's just like one person reported just, yeah, I've heard some weird noises. And we go in and just find a whole bunch of other stuff more than just weird noises. You know what I mean? It's
Yeah,
it can be pretty wild.
it's the joy of it, really. So, you're doing a big project, an upcoming project at the moment with the guys from Small Town Monsters, called Cursed Waters, Creature of Lake Okanagan. Have I pronounced that
Creature of Okanagan
right?
Lake.
Yeah.
It's an indigenous name, or it's a Canadian bastardization of an indigenous name.
Oh, right. Okay. Can you tell us about the project? Now we've
Yeah,
got over
this was,
my horrible pronunciation.
well, it's a lot of people stumble over it, you know, unfortunately. No, this was pretty cool. We shot it last year. I was approached by Eli Watson, who is a part of Small Town Monsters, and for people, their stuff has made it over to the UK now, I guess, within the last couple of years. They're an indie documentary company based out of Canton, Ohio, and they specialize in literally the title of their company, Small Town Monsters. They go to different towns where there's these stories, and they kind of investigate it in a very unbiased way, and kind of tell the story of these sort of mythological experiences. A lot of it to do with Bigfoot. They've done Mothman. They've done Dogman. You know, the Dogman Triangle, which is very good, and the book is really great as well, Aaron Dees's book. So they came up to Canada last May, and they were going to Harrison Hot Springs, which is the birthplace of Sasquatch, like where the name's John Green was sort of one of the first real investigators that really looked at Sasquatch, and that's where the name Sasquatch came from. So they're doing the origin of that. And Eli Watson, who's sort of a part of that, he had a few days where he could go kind of do what he wanted, and he's convinced Seth Breedlove, who runs the company, he wanted to go to Lake Okanagan and investigate Ogopogo, do a documentary on Ogopogo that was originally supposed to be part of his YouTube series Mysteries and Monsters. And he contacted me. I knew Eli. He was one of the first people that interviewed me about We Want to Believe when we started that, and he and I kind of became pretty good friends. And when I ran a YouTube channel for a while, his show Cryptid Campfire was on it as a video podcast, so we became, without meeting face to face, pretty good friends. And so he's like, I'm coming up to do something on Ogopogo. Do you want to join me? And what was kind of funny is I just started researching a book that I was writing about Ogopogo.
Oh, wow. Synchronicities.
It was one of those weird
Wow.
things. Literally, the week I started researching it is the week he reached and contacted me that they were
Oh,
coming up. And so I was like, yeah, for sure. Like, I'd love to be a part of that. And so everything came together. In May of last year, I joined him in Kelowna, and we filmed for 2.5. We did a whole documentary in 2.5 days. And then I joined him down in Harrison Hot Springs, and I was actually interviewed for On the Trail of Bigfoot, The Origin as well, which is coming out here in the next few months. And over time, as I was writing my book, the publisher that it was going to be published with, just the book became very different than what they wanted. And so they graciously released me from my contract. Small Town Monsters was very interested in picking up the book because it tied into this footage. And so the decision was made that instead of it being part of Mysteries and Monsters, it would become Cursed Waters, its own documentary. And then they would also release the book as a supplement material to that. And so Cursed Waters, right now, Small Town Monsters is doing its annual Kickstarter campaign. What is it called? They've reached their level that they want to reach. So it's the stretch goal. The first stretch goal is if it gets meet, people will get their own copies of Cursed Waters first and be able to see it before everybody else does. But it will premiere at Monster Fest at the end of June in Canton, Ohio, along with the
Fantastic.
book, which is being called, I think its title is now Legend of Ogopogo, Canada's Loch Ness Monster, is the full title of that.
Oh,
So pretty
wow.
excited about that.
Yeah, that would be amazing. So for I've heard of Ogopogo, but I don't know a lot about it. And for anybody who hasn't heard of it, can you tell us about the legend?
Yeah, it's of course, it's a part of the indigenous people's belief system, in the Okanagan. It is a six the length varies, but I mean it's been up to 60 feet long, creature with humps, kind of like a head of a horse with like antlers
Oh, wow.
kind of thing. And in the indigenous people's belief, that's it's a spirit of the lake. And that's kind of something doing this documentary and writing the book really changed my perception, because I didn't, you know, I don't, I love the idea of lake monsters. I have a hard time believing that something that big can exist in a limited body of water and not be seen more frequently, or a carcass not showing up. And so, but the doing the research and doing the interviews and being there, like seeing that it's a lake spirit that sometimes chooses to manifest itself in some kind of physical form that does then resemble this thing that people are seeing, became really fascinating to me. And so the book and the documentary became less about this ferocious lake monster, which when the settlers came in, it, the whole concept frightened them. And it became this ferocious beast. There have been accounts of like John McDougall was taking, you know, his horses across the lake. So he was in a boat and he had the horses attached to ropes and they would sort of swim across the lake. And in one instance, because he disrespected the lake and this whole concept, his horses started getting pulled underwater. And it nearly pulled his boat underwater. So he had to cut the ropes to let the horses go and he survived. But that's kind of where this whole concept of it being a ferocious beast came from. But that's the exact opposite of what it is. It's just the spirit of the lake. And if you respect it and you respect the water, it will treat you, you'll be fine. Yeah. If you sort of disrespect it, then you sometimes don't have safe travels across the lake. And I'm just sort of trying to really take this very complicated story and condense it into a few words for you here. Yeah. But that changed the whole, so the documentary is very much about conservation and, you know, and respecting the water and taking care of the water and the environment to not only for our own benefits, but for the benefits of these sort of this mythical spirit of the lake that's there.
Yeah.
And it also very much became about cultural misappropriation of indigenous beliefs. Cause it's not called Ogopogo. That was a name actually copyrighted by the village of Vernon, you know, in relation to it. It's like Nahaitu, I think is my bastardization of it. It has very much different spiritual connotations in the name as well, but they've taken it and Tourism Kelowna has taken this story and turned it into stuffed animals and books and a tourist draw, you know, much the same way that, you know, Nessie, that's happened with Nessie as well in Loch Ness, right? So it's about people, Western society, taking these very cherished indigenous beliefs and turning it into their own thing. And that became a big part of the book and the documentary as well. So, which Small Town Monsters was very interested in that, and it just didn't work with what the original publisher for my book wanted. They wanted just a series of different anecdotal stories about, you know, Ogopogo sightings, basically. And then that's fair enough. That sells, and that's fine, and that's what I set out to write. But in the course of writing this book, it became something completely different.
Yeah. Wow. I know it's quite interesting how to do with Nessie. Things get changed so much and people have become obsessed with trying to find proof of Nessie. And the more proof they try to find, they you know, they have sonar and they dive and goodness knows what. And the more obsessed they get with it, the more sort of outlandish the theories become. So my favourite theory, and I suppose it could technically be true, because the lochs in Scotland are so deep, they've got this theory that they're all joined together by deep underwater caverns and that the creature travels from one to another and maybe even it's connected to the sea as well. I love how these sort of stories happen. There's some similar ones, aren't there, to, is it Champ? Lake Champlain?
Yeah, Lake Champlain, Champ. Yeah. Yeah, and you know, it's funny, Ogopogo, sorry, Lake Okanagan's the same. People say, well, there's just a bunch of caves that connected to other lakes and to the thing. So it's funny how it's so similar. Like these stories are so similar, right? Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but that just jumped out at me. It's like, it's identical.
Identical story.
And actually, Nessie, like that whole surgeon's photo ruined the whole, like Nessie's descriptions actually traditionally are very similar to Ogopogo's. Very similar. It's not a plesiosaur. It's a long serpentine creature with a different, you know, head of like a kind of like a horse-like,
horse-ish,
different kind of head.
Dragonish kind of, yeah.
A dragonish head, yeah. Which I find fascinating too.
Oh, I love it. I still haven't been to Loch Ness, and I still have this wish to go and just sit there for a few hours and hope to glimpse something. Maybe I'll be lucky. You never know.
Same. I've been twice, just very briefly, and same. I wish I had, because it was on tours. Like I did a Kentucky tour in 95. And then my wife and I went on a tour for our first anniversary, but we only had like, you know, half an hour.
Yeah. Oh, that's no good.
I need days, man. I need days at Loch Ness.
Yeah. Although I do feel slightly ashamed that I actually live here and I haven't been. You've come from all that way and you've been twice. Shame on me. I must get out more. So you're also an author. As obviously you touched on one of the books. And they are, am I right in thinking they're part of a series called I Want to Believe? Is that right?
Yeah, there was like originally We Want to Believe was going to be called I Want to Believe. And what happened is, like, just before it was supposed to premiere on YouTube, another documentary came out called I Want to Believe. And so the decision
Oh.
was made that we need to change the title.
Yeah.
It is to
So
avoid confusion. How dare they, right? Even though there's a poster saying I Want to Believe and all that stuff. But yeah, Peter and I. We were kind of commissioned to write a book. The first book was called I Want to Believe, One Man's Journey into the Paranormal. And it was just detailing Peter's story, and the different investigations he went on. And that proved popular enough that we wrote a follow-up book called I Want to Believe, an Investigator's Archive, where we interviewed various people in the field and just sort of told their stories. Like one of them was Kieran O'Keefe, you know, who's been on,
Oh, he's
Kieran,
everywhere. He's everywhere.
he's everywhere. He's everywhere. He was
Being
gracious enough to.
skeptical.
He's awesome. I really like his interview was fascinating because he is so skeptical about it, but so interested at the same time. He was so we interviewed him. We interviewed like Ken Gearhard, who's a cryptozoologist in North America. Seth Breedlove, you know, from Small Town Monsters. You know, Paul Bradford, who's a ghost hunter, a bunch of people, plus people that Peter and I knew, and that came out. And then the third book was called Dying Light, and it was about near-death experiences. As well. So those three books were all with Beyond the Fray Publishing. And it was fun. They're fun books to write. And I mean, the near-death experiences one was sort of just more born out of a story that we heard that Peter had his own near-death experience. So we just tried to take as deep a dive into that subject as well and show the different theories about it and different stories that have come up and the similarities and differences, you know, and it was they've all been really fun to write. Like as a, someone who was a newspaper crime reporter for 10 years, it was nice to write nonfiction, you know, get kind of back into that, and it was pretty cool. And I mean, and that led to the Ogopogo book, which has been a joy, and that led to the documentary. So it's neat how things kind of progress and how one thing leads to another. And
Another, yeah.
yeah.
And did you find with the near, because I'm really fascinated with near-death experiences, and I think I might have to buy this book now. It's so many of them that I've heard involve a tunnel of light. Was that a common theme or
It was, yeah.
throughout,
There was a lot, not all, but many did a tunnel of light. And then something waiting for you on the other side of that tunnel of
yeah,
light kind of thing.
and
And
sending you back almost, so
yeah,
saying
that
it's
and that
not
was a
your
common
time.
theme as well, that these people who came back were it wasn't their time. It's almost like, you know, there's this predetermined time of when you're gonna go. And if you something happens it sends you first, they're like, nah, you better go back. But everybody who comes back changed. For one, they're not scared of death anymore. That was the big thing, is all these people who had these near-death experiences were no longer afraid to die. They didn't see it as a scary thing. And then some came back being far more intuitive, you know what I mean? And having more paranormal experiences, etc. And death just sort of, I think, more with a sense that they can be who they are. And if people have a problem with that, that's their problem, for lack of a better word too. So it seems to be this very, what you think would be a frightening experience was more often than not the complete opposite of that.
Yeah,
Which
because
was
some
neat to spend
people.
a book months writing it and researching it. And I now my vision of death has changed a lot too.
Is it true that a lot of people feel this great sense of almost peace and love, and they go, actually, sod life. I actually want to go here now because it feels so good. Is that what you've heard?
That was very common as well. There was only one story out of all of them that was actually frightening. Like it was a frightening, more of a frightening
Oh,
experience. But
really?
all the rest we had, they didn't want to go back, including Peter. Peter was saying, you know, he felt very guilty about that because he just had, you know, his wife and just had two kids and stuff. And he just, nope, I'm fine. I'm going to stay here. Right. It actually, you know, some people actually say it hurts to come back and it takes a long time to adjust.
I wonder if it has anything in common with astral projection, sort of like being sort of wrenched out of your body and then dragged back again. I don't know. Maybe there are similarities there.
I think, yeah, and that's something that did come up, and I wish I had, like, you know, there's you only have so much time in writing a book and so much space, that there was definitely a tie-in to astral projection, even like alien abduction, the circumstances were very, very similar, right? The big thing was that each person's experience was very subjective as well. It was based sort of on the experiences, their life experience played a big part in how this phenomenon played out. So it was fascinating.
And
Fascinating
was
stuff. The similarities too, like the kind of life review they call it, where you kind of suddenly see all the things that happened in your life where you were a jerk and you could kind of almost fix these things and learn from them. So when you went
yeah.
back, you were a better person. Like that, I found that really, the fact that a lot of people had that happen too, very similar, was very surprising.
Yeah, was that like their life playing out sort of in a filmic way in front of them almost?
Yeah, playing out in front of them. And then some, even it was even more elaborate, where like you're in this room and you can see all these different screens showing the different things in your life that happened where you affected someone or they had an impact on you. And the ones where you were like literally like a jerk to the grocery clerk, you could almost go back and correct it. Like they got really elaborate, like really, really elaborate. Which I part of me had trouble grasping that as a writer. You know what I mean? It's like, no, how? Like, how? But that's the stories they told. So you kind of, when writing that sort of book, you do have to take it a bit at face value, what they're telling you, right?
Well, yeah. And did you have many stories of one of my favorite sorts of experiences that I've read about are when people maybe are in surgery or on the hospital and they have these out of body experiences where they can look down and they can give people details that they wouldn't be able to tell them unless they had been doing what they say they'd been doing.
Yeah, that came up in some stories. Same with like the person in the room next to them, like the hotel, the hospital room. I was gonna say hotel, hospital room next to them. They could see that. You know what I mean? Like, that's all these. Yeah, all that stuff kind of is a part of this phenomenon. Not every time, but sometimes, right? Like especially when the near-death experience happened in a hospital, that sort of stuff. But one woman described it being in a car accident, and she suddenly was like, moment of impact, she's out of her body looking down at the car wreck and the paramedics taking care of her and all this stuff. And then boom, she's back in that body. You know what I mean? Like it's wild, wild stuff.
Gosh, it's a lot to think about. So, what have you got planned for the future? Have you got any projects coming up that you could tell us about, or something that you'd like to do, or people you'd like to work with?
Oh boy. Well, I know, like, I can't talk about some of it now, but there is sort of, it looks like a new homecoming for We Want to Believe and some other projects that I'm going to be working on that way. I'm taking a break from books, I think, for a while, because these are four books written in 4 years. That was a lot. We're continuing to investigate, and we're going to do some more presentations this year, for people, but that's sort of it. I mean, we're going on the road more now, especially now that basically the pandemic's kind of wound down. Like we did a quick trip to the States last year. We're going back for 5 days to Gooding, Idaho, to this place. It was a former tuberculosis clinic that we can get in and investigate. We went last year, and it's probably the most haunted places I've ever been to. We only had like 36 hours there last year, so we're going back for 5 days.
Oh, how exciting.
Late April, we're really excited about that. And yeah, just sort of see where this takes us. It's been a really, like, none of this was really planned. It sort of all just kind of happened, but it, and it's turned it sort of itself sort of into this sort of second life for me, which is something I kind of always wanted to do, and it's neat to how it's kind of working out nicely.
And so do you do this full time, or have you got a sort of another job as
No,
well,
it's I've been fortunate enough that I've been able to do this mostly full time, and there's times where I have to go out and just do odd jobs to sort of help pay the bills for a
yeah.
while. But it looks like things are going to work out that I can kind of make this, a more or less a full-time gig, which is great, because if I could do this now, till I'm ready to fully retire, I think that would be fantastic.
I think I'll be very, very envious of you. That's what I would love to do that. Like, it would be just amazing to go and actually get paid for it. I mean, I love doing it as a hobby, but it would be amazing.
Well, I know that, like, when I was running the YouTube channel, it was very much a paranormal themed YouTube channel, and I got kind of paid to run it and managed all the shows that run it. It was great. It's kind of like, oh, this is like the dream kind of thing. But the when something's your hobby that becomes your job, there's definitely a bit of a juggling act that suddenly goes on. It's like, wow, I got to find something else to do to relax. I started building Lego, which, you know, that became kind of my chill out, right? And, you know, going for more runs and hikes.
Well, yeah, because, yeah, you've got to do something else, haven't you? I do so many, I've got so many hobbies, and sometimes I think, oh, I really ought to pull back on these, because obviously it has an impact on my normal job. Because you can't do everything all of the time, but no. I love it so much. I don't want to. I just want someone to come along and go, "Hey, you're quite good at this. We'll pay you a load of money to do this full time." Like, hi, any takers?
Well, you never know. That's the thing, though. You never know when something's going to come around, right? That's why.
Yeah.
Like someone basically told me, like, you don't get if you don't try. So you just keep trying, and sooner or later, people do notice. Like, you've got a fine show, and someone's going to. You know, there's enough people listening, more people will listen, right? And you just never know, you might end up with a radio show out of it. Like, it can happen. It, you know,
that's what I'm hoping. And also, actually, I've been trying to take that philosophy into my life, because I speak to, like yourself, a lot of inspirational people I find inspirational, because they're doing the exact thing that I'd really like to be doing, and you get ideas from people, don't you? So my latest project is I work for Hospital Radio, doing a radio show.
Oh, nice.
So I'm trying to learn how to do DJ skills now. That's my next thing.
I've done radio. I did broadcasting for a few years, and it's a whole different beast. Like, I've done podcasts for a very long time. And then being on the radio changes just enough.
Do you do a podcast now? Or is that not something you're doing at the moment?
No, not at the moment. It was sadly one of the things that did fall apart with COVID. And the protocols and stuff like that. I really enjoyed it. I'd done a pop culture podcast for years, and it got picked up as sort of a morning segment on morning radio, and then became a primetime radio show. So that was the dream, you know, the dream. It took 11 years to get there, but it became the dream, and it ran for a couple of years on primetime. And then when the pandemic hit, it was just became basically impossible to keep it up.
Yeah.
Because everything fell apart around us kind of thing. So.
Oh, but you're on to bigger and better things now.
That's how I look at it.
Before we sign off, I just wondered if you have any particular experiences that you haven't told us about yet that you might be able to tell us about. I don't want to put you on the spot if you haven't thought of anything, but
there's one. I kind of look like there's like the three most profound ones. I've told you the two already. Obviously, that first one in the car, and then the one out at Tronc Hill with the door.
Yeah.
The third one, when I was growing up, my parents had a cabin on a lake called Little Shuswap Lake. And the Shuswap is sort of a region to the east of where I live. And that's where it's technically Bigfoot country.
Yeah.
And so I'd go out there all the time, and I'd quite often bring a friend because, you know, you're out there for weekends or a week at a time. And so I brought a buddy of mine named Mike, and he and I, the best thing about growing up when I did is we were free range children. So my parents are like, as long as you're around for breakfast, lunch, dinner, and bedtime, have at her. Like, so we'd be in the woods all the time.
Exactly the same. Yeah.
Yeah. And I love that. And we'd always take the same route in and out of the woods, where you'd kind of go up, cross the road, up this sort of logging road, past this stand of trees, and up, and then you just play. And so we came down for dinner, followed that route. Went, ate dinner, did the dishes, and we figured, let's go back out for another sort of rip around in the woods and stuff like that. And so we took the route up, and suddenly, where the stand of trees was, underneath, there were pine trees. So usually it's just littered with pine needles and pine cones and all that. Underneath one of the trees, suddenly, all the needles are gone, and all the pine cones are gone. There's this little lean-to built, and a fire pit made of rock. And inside the lean-to is a bone. And it's not a big enough lean-to for a person, but you could, some small could fit. It's almost like built for like a toy, like an action figure, you know, like a toy, like about that big.
All right.
But the bone, like a picked clean bone in there. And I'm not alone. So I knew I wasn't hallucinating. Like, Mike's there with me, and we still talk about it to this day. We were probably 13 or 14 at the time. And we're like, what the heck is this? Like, this is so bizarre. And like, it was like, we were literally like an hour, like, you know, just eating dinner and whatnot. And it's starting to get dark, and we're starting to feel really off, really uneasy. So I was like, let's just get out of here.
Yeah.
We went back to the cabin, but we couldn't stop talking about it. So the next morning, first light, even before breakfast, we got dressed, and we went right back up there. All that was gone. It was completely littered with pine needles and pine cones again, like nothing had happened.
No.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
And it wasn't till years later, I was talking to a friend of mine named Chris Bowes, who's an indigenous storyteller and artist. And I'm explaining it to him because that's big. Like there's not only indigenous belief is there just Bigfoot, but there's a whole bunch of different creatures and stuff. And I told him about it. He's like, dude, that was the little people.
Oh, wow.
Like, what do you mean? He says, yeah, no, they're little people and they roam around and they kind of cause trouble for people. And at night, typically everyone goes back into the cave to the other spirit world. But if they can't get back, they set up camp.
Oh,
and he's like,
goodness.
And that's what you saw. And I'm just like, okay, that's like a lot to digest, but I don't know if I believe it or not, but I know what I saw. And it was two people. We saw this. It was not there. It was there and it was gone again.
Wow. That's incredible. I mean, a lot of societies around the world, I'm thinking particularly of Ireland, have sort of traditions of little people or stories of little people, like the leprechauns in Ireland, and southern England, you've got fairies, and there are other, obviously, kind of Nordic countries that believe in fairies and elves and gnomes and all sorts of things. And it's just fascinating. But to actually see something is quite incredible.
It was. It's one of those, like, if it had been just been me, I would doubt myself. You know what I mean? I'd be like, yeah, I don't. Yeah. Maybe I just, who knows? I ate some weird food or something like that.
Yeah.
It
yeah.
didn't sit right. But there was two of us and we both saw it and we still talk about it. And then to be able to tell the story to someone who kind of supports it with their belief ideas, which I think the little people probably tie into, like, it's their version of fairies or gnomes or whatever, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's crazy. It was one of those, again, one of those defining things. He and I were both already interested in this stuff. That's what Mike and I bonded over, was talking about paranormal, and he had a number of experiences. So for us to experience that, it's out of this world. And there's been enough stuff, again, that's happened to me, even outside of investigating, where it's like, there's something going on here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I find that I'm currently, currently investigating my own kitchen, where very strange things happen. And I don't live in an old house, but it's more a case of things appearing out of thin air and then disappearing. You know, like when you lose your keys, and you knew that they were there, and you look there and you look there and you look there again, and then you go away and you come back and there they are. And things like that happen all the time in my kitchen. It feels like a really weird place, but I just love all that sort of thing. And I really like the idea of little people as well. I think that's amazing.
It's kind of neat.
Have you ever been, I mean, I know you sort of mentioned it a little bit, earlier, but have you ever been sort of Bigfoot hunting, sort of going out there looking for evidence for Bigfoot?
Yeah, we did that. We did that for some episodes of We Want to Believe, and we decided to tackle the Bigfoot story. That's when I told Chris Bowes about my story. That's where the little people came up as well. But we did. We just sort of in our region, because it is Bigfoot country, and we picked up wood knocks.
Oh.
At this remote lake where it was interesting. We found a gentleman who, he's a hunter and a fisher, and he's been going to this one lake up in the Bonaparte Plateau, which is sort of north of us, for like 20 years. Mm-hmm. And when he's out on his fishing boat, whenever he gets to one end of the lake, he hears these knocks, these three knocks. And so he took us up there and we looked around and took the boat out. And it was funny. We went to this part of the lake. There was myself and Marcus, who's one of the camera guys, and this gentleman who's our guide, and my buddy Sean. He stayed behind because we couldn't all fit in the boat.
Yeah.
And of course, we go to this part of the lake where he hears these knocks. We don't hear anything. We even like set foot on land. This is the first time this guy had set foot on land where the knocks had come from. Nothing happened. We get in the boat and we're going back, and Sean's like yelling. And we get close enough. I'm like, what? And he's like, did you hear the knocks? I'm like, no, that was us, because we did go do wood knocks on that side of the lake to try to.
Yeah.
Draw some attention. He's like, no, no, no. It was before that. And he's like, and it came from over there. He pointed to a completely different part of the lake, but he recorded them and he picked them up on his phone. So
do you think that was kind of a warning?
Pardon me?
Do you think it was like a warning? Like, don't come any closer, or.
Well, that's one of the theories about it, right? is that it's a warning or letting you know that this is our territory. And it's all just theories. Nobody, anyone who tells you this is exactly what it is, there's no way you could know, but it's definitely some form of like acknowledgement or warning or communicating. The fact that it happened when we were in the spot where it had gone off before, nothing suggests to me that if there was something there, it saw us coming and how intent we probably were and moved, you know what I mean? And sort of sent the warning off anyways. We probably maybe didn't like us being there on that part of the lake. So it was interesting. That was the best luck we had on a Bigfoot hunt.
Oh, that's great. And finally, I just want to ask you about your opinion on UFOs. First of all, have you seen anything strange in the skies? And secondly, do you have a theory on what UFOs are?
I'm probably one of those few people that hasn't had a UFO experience. Like I just haven't. I've seen things in the sky, but most of it has been, I've been able to debunk, like it was the space station or whatever. So I have never seen anything bizarre. I know people who have. What are they? I don't know. I it wouldn't surprise me that we're being visited by something from another planet. I don't know if I tie into this huge conspiracy that people like to get, you know what I mean, that's going on. I don't know. I think all this stuff is somehow related. That's my big thing. It's like the guy who wrote Mothman Prophecies, his name's escaping me.
John Keel, is it?
John Keane. Yeah, John
Keel.
Yeah. John Keel. John Keel. He believed all this stuff was related somehow. And part of the same phenomenon. And that's kind of where I take it from too. Like he pointed out, you know, and it's even written in the Bible, like the chariots of the gods during the time of the pharaohs. And then suddenly we start seeing like these weird airship dirigibles during kind of the Victorian slash industrial age. And now they're these high-tech spacecraft, like what we're seeing now as we've got more advanced technology. Whatever it is, I think is communicating with us. And it's doing it in a way that we can understand it at the time. So perhaps they're not from outer space, perhaps they're from that other dimension where these other things are coming from. A lot of people are seeing UFOs that are also in places where there's like poltergeist activity or Bigfoot activity.
Yeah.
I think the more open we're getting to the fact that this is all kind of one phenomenon, I think the closer we will get to possibly getting an answer to it. But there's so many camps, like the UFO camp doesn't want to be friends with the Bigfoot camp, and who doesn't want to be friends with like the ghost hunting camp?
Yeah.
But I think the only way we're going to even get close to answers is if we all work together, which no one seems to want to do.
I know. It just seems like a no-brainer to me. But people get very funny about being right and you know, we don't talk to that group and we don't talk to that group. It just seems ridiculous to me.
I think it's because each group wants to be the one that gets the definitive proof.
Yeah.
So they don't want to play with anybody else, right?
Exactly. That's
just, that just seems foolish. It's ego. It's ego.
It is. And surely it doesn't matter as long as we do find things out. I mean, surely that's it, isn't it?
That's the point, right?
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you, Jason. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Can I ask you where people can find you online and what websites they should go to and how to contact you and things like that?
Sure. I mean, I'm on Facebook, obviously, Jason Hewlett, Instagram, Jason Hewlett Official. We do have a Canadian Paranormal Society.ca website. That you can check. And also the Canadian Paranormal Society is on Facebook as well. We don't like have any designated site for We Want to Believe yet. But we'll see sort of what happens here in the next few months for that. But that's the best way to track us down is sort of on Instagram or Facebook, or come and say hello or send me a message.
Yeah. Okay. Fantastic. Well, do let us know of your future pursuits and we'll have you back on in the future and have a chat about that. But it's been really lovely talking to you. So thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Michaela. It's been great. Yeah, and I'd love to come back on anytime.
Cheers. Thanks.
Thank you so much to Jason for coming on the podcast. That was a really, really interesting conversation. And yes, I'd love to have Jason back on the podcast at some later date. So don't forget, everybody, I'm really going to start plugging this even more now. People aren't ringing in to tell me their paranormal experiences, and I really want to get a little episode together with lots of readers' and listeners' experiences. So come on, guys, do me a favour. All you have to do is press record on your phone and email it to me at 07935 100 162. That's 07935 100 162. Or you can send me a voice note from your voice recorder, or via WhatsApp on paranormalorwhatpodcast@outlook.com. paranormalorwhatpodcast@outlook.com. I really want to know what experiences you've had. And also, please recommend the podcast to other people so that we can build our listenership. And rate and review the podcast for me. If you like it, if you listen every week, please rate and review the podcast on your chosen platform. Now, the last thing I'm going to do is I'm just going to tell you all about a little spooky fact. I thought I'd do a little bit in the podcast every week where I tell you one or two spooky facts. So, here we go. This one is all about Disneyland's famous Pirates of the Caribbean ride. Did you know that it used real skeletons? The engineers from Disney took one look at the fake skeletons that were initially brought in and thought they weren't creepy enough. Might be because prosthetics in the 1960s weren't as convincing as they are now. Anyway, to offer a more authentic experience, Disney engineers enlisted the help of the University of California, Los Angeles' anatomy department, for real skeletons. Oh my goodness. I think if some people would have known that, they wouldn't have gone on the ride. I would, though. Spooky fact number two. Did you know that Wes Craven's A Nightmare on Elm Street is based on a real story? No, I didn't know that either. Director Wes Craven revealed that the inspiration for the iconic slasher film came from a story he read from the LA Times. A boy was having disturbing nightmares and refused to sleep for days out of fear. The same night he succumbed to exhaustion, he died in his sleep, but not before screaming for help in the middle of the night because of his nightmares. Oh my goodness, how terrifying. And your final spooky, creepy fact is, did you know as many as 50 serial killers are on the loose in the United States at any one time? This number is according to the FBI. However, some, including homicide archivist Thomas Hargrove, speculate that around 3,000 to 4,000 serial killers remain active in the country as we speak. Well, those of you over the pond, I hope you're going to sleep well in your beds tonight. I might be getting that baseball bat out and sticking it under my bed if I were you. Okay, everybody, well, it's been fabulous talking to you as usual, and don't forget to tune in to the podcast again next week. But for now, it's way past my bedtime, and I need to switch off the lights in my house and go hunting around in my spooky kitchen to find some of those ghosties. So, take care. Don't forget to have that nip of something hot and spicy. And I'll speak to you next week. Night.